Hello and welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg, as usual, powered by Research Luxembourg. And in today's show, our guest is Professor Lindsay Flynn. Lindsay is an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Luxembourg and Principal Investigator for the PROPEL project, Proactive Policymaking for Equal Lives. The project examines the links between governmental policy, housing markets, and inequality by looking at the challenges current generations face in high-income OECD countries. Lindsay was also recently one of the organizers of the Housing Day at the University of Luxembourg, where research was connected with policy and practice. Lindsay, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Anna.
A lot of challenges and all the combinations together. I'm very excited to talk about it. I have to say I'm right now trying to sell my flat, so I will not ask you for advice.
Yes, I am not going to predict the future here, unfortunately.
That's the sad part, because I think we're all kind of on the same boat here in Luxembourg, and housing is very important for us.
Absolutely.
So we'll definitely discuss it from a research perspective. But first of all, I was just wondering, as I just said, you're a professor of political science. So a political scientist and housing, what's the link here? I thought that's not really linked, or is it?
Yeah, so it is linked. So housing is really big. It's connected to everything. So, you know, there's the macroeconomic, what's going on in national or global economies. There's the microeconomic, what's going on in households, or the geographic, what's going on in urban areas versus rural areas, or within communities, or why do people make the decisions they do, their behaviors? Why do you decide to sell a flat when you decide to sell a flat? So I've designed the team to be interdisciplinary. We are in political science, sociology, and psychology. So you can check out actually the whole PROPEL team on the website. But political science can bring a few things to this. So first of all, housing policy has a really big role in shaping how we interact with the housing market. In housing policy is very political. It's governments that make it. So this is really part of political science. Things like home ownership and housing prices, they've been found to affect things like voting behavior and preferences for redistribution. And so that's obviously something that political scientists study. But for me, at the end of the day, the big thing is that political science is about a study of power. So who holds power? How do they wield that power? And housing drives many of the inequalities that we see today. And at the end of the day, inequality is about power differentials. So political science is a natural home since we study power, and housing markets and things like home ownership are kind of driving who holds power and how they wield it.
Okay, so we say political science, we say politicians. So that means that you're trying to get into the dialogue. How is it going with dialogue with politicians?
So in PROPEL, what we're trying to do is develop a framework to understand different kinds of housing inequalities. And so there's a few different parts to that. So one part of that is trying to understand what is going on in the political arena. We do look at contemporary housing policies, of course, but we also look historically. And so there's been a lot of changes since the 1990s. And so we're looking at what has happened politically from the 1990s forward. And then we're trying to engage with policymakers today to see what are the policies that are being generated, what policies do they care about, what are some of the outcomes that they're looking for, and then engage with policymakers in that way. It's a study in some sense of what elected officials and other forms of policymaking, right? Civil servants are part of this. NGOs are part of this. All of the policy implementation stage. That's one big part of what we do.
What I particularly find interesting is that you have this European lens in the project. So, of course, we are based in Luxembourg, so we will definitely at a certain moment discuss Luxembourg. But in general, you also have different countries that you look at. Do you try to also compare and contrast, or do you do studies separately for separate countries?
Yeah, so we do a bit of both. So we, in our work, look at Europe and the U.S. as the big comparative case. And when we look at housing, there's lots of theories about why countries have the housing policies that they do. So we engage with a lot of that theory building as well. It's something called housing regimes. And we can see that the Anglo-speaking countries, the U.S. included, have a particular type of housing policies. They're more likely to have deeper, more financialized mortgage markets, lower levels of social housing. You have northwestern continental Europe. Often many of these had what we call unitary or integrated rental markets. So there's more of a place for something like social housing, and sometimes a little bit less in terms of deep mortgage markets. You have the familial southern European countries. So these countries are less likely to have strong social housing, but also less likely to have deep mortgages. And so it's the family that is often relied on more in securing things like purchasing a home. And so there's a natural way to compare these across these three general groups that I'm looking at. One thing that's really interesting is that over the last couple of decades, we've seen at least some level of convergence across these countries. So you might take the case, for instance, of Sweden or Denmark or the Netherlands. These are countries that have traditionally been somewhat reliant on social housing and are just in general known for more equitable outcomes. And they've been moving more towards a financialized housing market. You look at Southern Europe, more familial, places like Spain and Portugal have also been moving more towards this marketized model. And so we look across these countries because you can then see where has there been convergence and divergence in housing policies and in the outcomes that we care about.
Do you also know why there is that move? I'm a journalist, so I want to know the why. And I know that as a scientist, it's sometimes difficult to give that.
Yeah, so there's been a few things. And of course, you know, I'm a social scientist, so we always have this degree of uncertainty. And we're working with people and policy, so there's always the unexpected and the unknown. But we can see some trends, and some of them may be intentional, maybe some are not. One trend, at least since the 1990s, is in up until the financial crisis, right? So this sort of changed some of the policy making. But there was an increased emphasis on becoming a homeowner. Countries were, you know, in some ways prizing themselves for being homeownership societies. This enabled a particular strategy to develop, if you will. And in the field, we call it asset-based welfare. But the idea here is that if you are a homeowner, you've created this store of housing wealth, and you can use that store of housing wealth as a supplement when your income is low. So the classic example here is when you retire, when you become a pensioner. Then if you're a homeowner and you have paid off your mortgage, then you can either have less income because you don't have a mortgage payment, or you could sell your home, downsize into something smaller, and use those capital gains as an income stream. So if governments were intentionally pursuing this, it creates this system where home ownership is prioritized over the rental market. And it also means that you need additional market structures because you need more people to have the ability to acquire mortgages. And so it just naturally moves towards this more marketized development. But at the end of the day, one of the bigger dimensions is that income and wealth inequality are continuing to increase. And this sort of snowballs, if you will, because you have individuals and investment organizations who are looking for places to park their capital, park their investment, right? And housing is a place to do that. That often can increase house prices. House prices need to increase in perpetuity if individuals are using it as a pension replacement. And so it just creates this cycle. So even though there's a lot going on, there's in general been this trend towards marketization because it meets the goal of increasing house price valuation.
You said that there is a trend towards home ownership. And to be honest, what I noticed from my younger friends is exactly the opposite. Basically, nobody can own anything, at least in Luxembourg, but not only, also in Poland, from where I'm from, and other countries. So what is it? What do you notice and what am I seeing? Is it my bubble just?
It's that two shifts have occurred, and this is why we couldn't have ever expected this to just increase in perpetuity. So shift number one happened during the global financial crisis, which if we all sort of think back to what were the original prompting forces of the crisis, it was housing. And it showed just how connected the global economy is through housing and housing markets. So since the crisis, we've seen a decline in homeownership. That doesn't mean that there's been a shift in social norms. People still think in general of homeownership as the aspirational goal. So often there's some dissonance, especially for young people, in not being able to acquire that. And then the second is precisely what you mentioned. We're seeing this as problematic, especially especially within the younger generations. So if you became a homeowner in the 1990s, when house prices were not particularly high or expensive in relation to income, you could possibly buy the house on one income instead of two. You could buy it in your 20s instead of your 30s or your 40s. And that's just not possible for young people now. And this is an area that is a particular focus of the Propel Project, looking at what are the specific challenges that young people are facing. And young people are not always young anymore. That this is occurring in
your
30s and 40s are still considered still trying to break into the housing market.
Good point, because when we say young people, different people might have different ideas for the definition. So good you mentioned that. Before you tell me a little bit more about that kind of younger generations and their struggle, I actually wanted to look a bit at wealth. Of course, we'll be talking a lot about housing in particular, but you have something more general for us. So as usual, if you can ask the question, and listeners, remember the answer is only at the end of the podcast.
Okay, so a little bit of context here. There's lots of ways to measure inequality, but one easy statistic to remember if we're thinking about wealth is the share of wealth that is held by the top 10% of the wealth distribution. So the pub question is, about how much wealth is held by the wealthiest 10% of households in Europe?
So we are looking for a percentage.
A percentage.
Perfect. Thank you very much. We will only reveal the answer at the end of the podcast. One of the trends you said is that there is a shift towards home ownership. What else is there when it comes to housing wealth?
There are a few dimensions that are really important. So interestingly, and it makes sense if you think about it, if home ownership rates are high, wealth inequality levels tend to actually be a little bit lower because more people are homeowners and homes are the primary form of wealth for the vast majority of households. And so there were in, say, you know, call it the long 1990s, the potential for wealth inequality levels to decrease because home ownership rates were increasing.
There was a potential, but yes, we lost it, I assume.
So my colleague Caroline DeVield and I have looked at housing wealth levels for young people, and we're using the high threshold for young people. People who are 44 or under, I think, is the age that
we looked at. I
still qualify. Yes, I still qualify too, thankfully, just barely. And so we looked at the comparison was between 2010 and 2017 in what happened with housing wealth during those times. And what we saw is that in the 12 countries that we looked at, so the US and then 11 European countries, in 11 of them, wealth concentration increased at the highest end of the income distribution. This was a number of different types of countries. So Greece and Italy, looking at Southern European countries, continental countries like France and Germany, as well as the Netherlands, something, you know, is seen a little bit more as a social democratic form, and Luxembourg. There are multiple reasons for this, and I don't think we will ever know all of the reasons that contribute to this type of wealth concentration. But some of the possibilities that we and others have considered and found support for are things like increased volatility in the labor market and in the housing market. So in countries that had higher unemployment rates, there is more concentration and wealth in the upper end of the income distribution. In countries that had greater volatility in house prices, there was greater concentration of wealth in the upper end of the income distribution, but also things like uneven capital gains across income and location. And so it's not that if you are buying even at the top of your means as a low-income household and a high-income household, that you can expect the value of the flat that you bought or the house that you bought to increase at the same rate. And so there seems to be some selectivity going on here too.
Could we also talk about certain countries that are just not so much promoting youngsters leaving their house?
There are a lot of cultural differences here, and we see this historically, that the rate of leaving the parental home has always been a bit later in Southern Europe than it is in Northern and Western Europe. But in general, when young people are queried, they are saying that they would rather leave the parental nest earlier, acquire independent housing, and they're simply unable to, especially with just their own income. So this is something that they might need parental support for. They might need to have roommates instead of rooming by themselves. They might need to partner up, right? So there's lots of social implications to this to be able to find that way to acquire independent housing.
So we have that side for sure, but then I wanted to just think about a bit more general before we go again deeper into your project. We talk a lot about housing. At least in my bubble, I have a feeling the discussion is really going on. But I have also a feeling we're missing something there. There are points we're not discussing. So I have this amazing opportunity today to ask you, what are we missing in the whole discussion about housing and housing crisis?
So this is really hard to come at until we talk about what we mean by this buzzword here, housing crisis. So what kind of crisis are we in right now? We know that there was a global financial crisis and that it was driven by housing markets. But are we in another one of those crises? Are we in, you know, the bursting of a housing bubble? No, I don't think that's what we're talking about when we talk about housing crisis. So are we talking about an affordability crisis? Is that the crisis? And then is it a supply crisis or an identity crisis because there's no clear pathway to home ownership or building housing wealth? So this question is one of the actually core questions that we look at in Propel, is trying to problematize what we mean by housing crisis and try to understand the contours of what this crisis looks like. One of the ways that we do this, and this is an area that I think mostly we've been missing, is by looking across different kind of target groups. So what I mean by this is that we have traditionally looked at housing from an economic perspective, or if we're talking about it from a social perspective, we're talking about social housing. We're talking about just one specific dimension of housing policy, which in many countries is relatively small, the level of social housing stock that is available. What we're doing in Propel is trying to look at not just the economic side, so not just income and wealth, but all of these social dimensions as well. This means we're looking across generations. It means that we're looking across gender and family type, and it means that we're looking across race, ethnicity, immigration status. And these have all been touched on at different points by a number of scholars. But since the financial crisis, much of this has been overshadowed by the, you know, bread and butter issue of, can we afford housing? So this is the direction that I think we need additional research so that we really see just how deeply the housing market is affecting our lives.
You mentioned a lot social housing and the lack of it. So would just increasing the supply solve the problem, or is it more about what comes as a package with it? What could we do about social housing as such?
One of the dimensions that you could look at this as, here is a potential solution, and this may not work for all countries, but is to begin thinking about this idea of tenure neutrality. And tenure neutrality is something that is the opposite of most countries becoming homeownership societies. And so it would mean that individuals have more choice depending on their preferences and depending on where they're at in the life course to determine what form or what type of tenure fits best. This is where the question of social housing can come in as one feasible alternative for individuals of different types. So we can look and see the rate of social housing in different countries over time. And for the most part, social housing has declined. You know, this was seen very clearly in the case of the Right to Buy program in the UK under Margaret Thatcher, but in other countries, it's declined too. If this is a no longer politically palatable solution, then you begin thinking about, are there other forms of rental housing, even in the private market, that would be helpful and relevant and desired by people? This can mean looking at things like housing subsidies for the rental market, creating set of regulations that make sure that the quality of housing in the private rental market and the social rental market are both of the same type. So often we see that social housing is more regulated in terms of any number of dimensions, in that if there's higher levels of social housing, at least this is the way the theory goes, if there's higher levels of social housing in a country, it will prompt the private market to be integrated in a sense. And so this then offers more viable opportunities for all types of households, especially young people who will not become buyers right away in most instances. I think the question is that a direction that countries are moving or not? And it's not a question that I can answer as a researcher, but is a deeply political question for elected officials and for voters to determine what types of housing are the right types of housing for society.
And of course, when we talk about subsidies, we also have to look at the influence they have in general on the market, right? And this is also something you do focus on. So rental subsidies, and then what happens with the market later on if you decide to implement them?
So the idea here is that a rental subsidy, and there's different kinds of rental subsidies, but a rental subsidy would enable someone who couldn't quite reach the market rent for a private rental unit to receive some supplemental income, and then they're able to be successful in the private market. And this could serve in some ways as a replacement for social housing if there's either not enough social housing or if it's not in a location that people are living at for jobs or for whatever reason. There's some evidence that subsidies in the rental market could, in the medium to long term, increase the price of rental housing. So this would mean that, you know, landlords would then increase the price of the rent because they know that tenants would be receiving some type of study. But there's not as much evidence of this as you would think, given the popular narrative of that explanation. And there is also the dimension that the benefit that the rental subsidy has is not fully taken by the increase in rent. And so these are still helpful. And of course, if we're moving it down to the person level, if a subsidy can help someone both acquire housing and meet all of their other financial obligations, then this seems like it is a type of policy that would be worthwhile to pursue. And if you're looking at the data, most countries have a rental subsidy program. So if its existence is any evidence that policymakers think that it's worthwhile, then we do see some evidence there. But I think that it, again, it's a question of what societies really want their housing markets to look like. What kind of housing do people want to be in? So you mentioned the housing day. When we were looking at different types of activities that we could do, one activity in one breakout session that we ran was on alternative forms of housing. So really looking at the ways in which co-ops or forms of housing that are not sole proprietor ownership models could work. And I unfortunately wasn't in that breakout group, but it seemed like from the summary that there was among the participants an interest in that kind of housing arrangement. So having these conversations and questioning what the traditional view of the last several decades has been might be something that is worthwhile at the societal level.
So definitely there are loads of different options here. We have the tiny houses and we have some other co-ops and other options that we should pursue. And it's definitely a place to talk about it because Luxembourg has a lot to do. Also, you mentioned the housing days. I was just thinking that, to be honest, I've been to a lot of conferences here in Luxembourg, a lot of different webinars, seminars, everything. And it was the first one, maybe it's just me, but it was the first one where I saw really the practitioners and the researchers coming together and actually having conversations. So it was not like, okay, we present and you present. But as you said, the breakout groups was the moment when you just really shared the experience and the knowledge and tried to find some solutions afterwards. So how did it go and what are your takeaways from that day?
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that you thought that it felt a little bit different. And that was precisely the goal of the day, was to bring together people who very rarely get a chance to sit in the same room together. So bring together researchers with civil society, NGOs, with policymakers and public servants, of course, with students, you know, we're here at the university, to begin talking about where are the potential synergies in the type of work that we do. And so we started with some, you know, taking stock activities where we did a set of presentations about what research is going on in Luxembourg. We had a whole bunch of posters so that people who might not be following the research space as closely as I do, for instance, could see the types of research that we're doing here. Then we had a panel for practitioners to highlight some of the really amazing programs and services that are here in Luxembourg. And then we spent a big chunk of the day in coffee breaks and having meals together and in breakout sessions talking about specific topics that we thought were of interest to the Luxembourg community. So we talked about alternative forms of housing. We talked about this concept of the right to housing, since Luxembourg has recently introduced the right to housing as an objective with constitutional value into the constitution. We talked about the idea of housing first as a way to combat homelessness and those who are in the most economically precarious position. And through all of these, we tried doing it in a way that both researchers and civil society and NGOs were really in the same room so that we could get different kinds of expertise. We did this in the organizing committee for the whole day, was a mix of researchers and nonprofit organizations. Each of the breakout groups had a co-lead. One was a researcher, one was from civil society. And then we also tried at the beginning of the day to try to understand why people might be interested in this collaboration. So for me, collaboration is what leads to innovation. And so this is why I think that this kind of work is important. But that doesn't mean that everyone thinks that. And of course, we had a little bit of self-selection, right? People who came to this day are interested in collaboration. But we asked the group on an instant poll how much impact collaboration can have. And it was a resounding like 4.3, 4.4, 4.5 out of 5 that collaboration can have a lot of impact. Then we did an instant poll and said, well, what are the barriers to this collaboration? And it was really clear that things like time and funding and resources, that these were the by far the biggest barriers that people were identifying. To me, okay, yes, money is scarce. Money and funding is hard to come by. But to me, this is actually pretty encouraging because it didn't indicate that there's irreconcilable differences across these sectors. It means that we need to figure out a way to easily bring people together. All of the other things were like, you know, comfort or knowledge or ability to communicate across. These are all surmountable. These are what things like the Housing Day can do, is offer a process and an infrastructure for doing things like this. So what will come of this? I have no idea. The expectation is that we'll do a big event like that every year and some smaller events throughout the year, and that we'll see what the next few years bring and what types of innovations could occur from the collaborations.
Yeah, well, definitely. I'll be keeping my fingers crossed for that, because as I said, it was for me personally an interesting event because I knew both sides a bit, which normally, you know, is not the case. I could also hear from both sides what they were thinking about the whole room and collaboration, because I know some people, for example, for the Tiny House Association. So, you know, I could also see that working, you know, there was a bubbling kind of feeling for sure. Leaving now the housing day, going back to housing as such, I was also thinking there is one more definition that we did not discuss, and I was just wondering how you as a researcher define it. What is actually affordable housing? How do we look at this?
This is something that has changed over time in my field. So if you had asked that question, maybe even 10 years ago, the answer would have been affordable housing is more or less synonymous with social housing or with housing that is specifically designed for low-income households who can't acquire housing or cannot easily acquire housing on the private market with market rents. That definition, in my mind, is shifting a bit. And it's shifting because affordability concerns are moving higher into the income distribution. So middle-income households are now finding it increasingly difficult to afford housing. This leads us to a handful of more specific metrics that we can use. In general, 30% and 40% are percentages that are thrown around if you're looking at statistics, where if you're spending less than 30% of your income on housing, then you're in a position of affordability. If it's more than that, it's unaffordability. If you're spending 40% or more of your income on housing, then you're in a state of housing cost overburden. And many people are in that state.
I have to break in here. Isn't that exactly how mortgages work here? That banks give you like 40%. If it's 40% of your income, you can still get a mortgage?
Yeah, more or less. Or it depends on a whole bunch of different risk factors and a household's profile. But they want you to be spending, you know, less than 40 or even better, less than 30% of your income on a mortgage.
Thinking about the people who do have mortgages here, that when you reach that 40%, that becomes exactly, I mean, you feel it as a burden, obviously.
Yeah. And of course, it also depends on what other debt you hold. And so then they're looking at different, you know, full debt to income ratios when they do that.
Yes, true. Okay, coming back. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, not a problem at all. The question of inequality then comes back in full force here, because we can't just say 30% is affordable and 40% is overburdened. And what we've seen is that for low-income households, it could be anywhere from 10 to 20% of your income. If you're spending more than that on housing, then you are in a state where you can't afford other basic necessities. If you look at very high income earners, they could be spending 50% of their income on housing costs and still not feel as if they can't afford their basic necessities or other types of goods. So this, I think, gets at the point of why Propel isn't just about opportunities in general, but tries to look at inequality as this sort of driver, in that so many of the opportunities that households are facing are driven by the higher than normal wealth inequality levels that we see.
Okay, so we're touching upon, again, very serious discussion. So I have to ask for the solutions, right? So Lindsay, what do you think? What shall we do? I don't want to be like a doom podcast today. So I really want to see, are there any options for us? We're talking very general. Of course, we have to focus also on different markets, different countries. You can't just say, okay, this is one solution that fits all.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to be a one solution fits all, because as I said earlier, housing affects everything, right? So even if you find something that makes housing more affordable, it may not have any impact on whether or not working mothers can go from the home that they bought that's much further away from their job to the creche, right? I mean, just to sort of bring in one of the social dimensions that we look at. But I think that there are increasingly some accepted dimensions that we could consider. I don't think any of them will ever be full solutions, and it will depend on the country. But using some of the research that we've already done, I think that there are three. One is that we could ensure that the rental market is a viable option when and where it's relevant. And so this is thinking about the possibility of greater tenure neutrality within countries and who that would work for if renting is a viable option for some or all of their life. And of course, this is a big societal question, because if people want to be homeowners, then this needs to become part of this calculation. But I think renting is always going to be one step along the process for many households. So making sure that that process is working. Enabling a greater understanding under what conditions home ownership is a financially sound investment. I'm from the United States, and in the US, this narrative is particularly prevalent that there are some financially sound decisions and some not, right? There's an entire market that revolves around things like financial literacy and, you know, becoming your own investor. But I've done some research on the ways in which people build wealth and become homeowners, and the conditions are very specific for that to particularly financially beneficial. And in some cases, it's just not. So having a greater understanding of when it makes sense and enabling people to then make that decision more carefully and with more confidence. And
breaking in here. So basically what you're saying is that it's not always good to invest in your own home?
Yes.
Okay, that's surprising for me, because the message I was getting, I don't know whether it was from the US or wherever else, is exactly like, that's the thing you should be thinking of, not about, you know, building your household and it's important to have a home, but just exactly, this is the investment. Yes, you should go for it.
And this is, you know, when we started, we were talking about this idea that most of Europe and the US, it's a homeownership society, which means that this is the preference of people that is in part determined by the narrative that this is what we should be doing, right? The housing policy is not immune to any other area where all of these social cues have a play. So I'm not saying that housing and homeownership is not financially sound for many, if not most people, but there is some real variety in this and that the types of things that you do are dependent. So let me just give you one example from the United States. We found that individuals who were less financially risky were more likely to be homeowners, but those who were more financially risky were more likely to have greater levels of housing wealth. And so there are some differences here in even the kinds of strategies that you used, if it was a savings strategy or if it was using credit card debt. And so there's a big group of strategies that may or may not add up to a financially viable nest egg at the end of your working years. But in general, home ownership will build wealth. Renting cannot. So we always have to keep that in mind.
Okay. And you said there were three. So what's the third one?
Yeah. So this goes back to political science, actually, bringing to the public discussion questions of fairness. So if we have high levels of inequality, it typically means that risk is not shared equally. And often it's that those who are in the most precarious housing positions are the ones who are holding a disproportionate burden of risk. So we have different definitions of what fairness is. You know, is it the equality of opportunity matters, equality of outcome, equality of process. So one of the things that I'd like to do in future events like the Housing Day is actually bring some of these definitions about, you know, what do scholars think fairness is? What are different definitions? What are different definitions of equality? In which one of those definitions or ones of those definitions are nation states using as they craft their housing policy? And I think having that discussion helps us understand the potential paths forward in the housing market.
And how do you define fairness?
Ooh.
Do we have enough time for that?
You know, we probably have enough time for that because I think I always equivocate on this because I'm, at the end of the day, a teacher. So my role here is to say, you know, here are the handful of definitions. Oftentimes, those who are more politically conservative will take a definition that is about fairness of process. That may not be the only definition. So those who are more liberally inclined may say, well, the process can't be fair if there are different starting points, which means that you then need to look a little bit at equality of outcome. I don't have one that I think is actually the best definition. But I think it's important that we as a community, and here, you know, I'm considering myself part of the community, realize that there are different definitions and that we may be talking past one another because we just accept different definitions of fairness.
And that's a very crucial thing also when you have these kind of meetings of different, you know, sides of the whatever table, let's say, because exactly if you don't start with how you understand the basic points, then the discussion will not lead you to the right outcome, or at least interesting outcomes, I would say. I'm afraid that this is the moment that we start wrapping up slowly. And listeners, remember, wrapping up in our podcast means going back to the pub quiz question. So as usual, Lindsay, if you can repeat the question, and then we will solve it.
Okay. So the question is about how much wealth is held by the wealthiest 10% of households in Europe.
And the answer is?
About 50%.
It always gets me very angry. So I do know the number because, you know, I'm interested in that, but I can't be very neutral about it, I have to say.
Yeah. So to put this into perspective, that means that it's double that of income. So about 25% of income is held by the top 10% of the income distribution. So we know that there's greater inequality in wealth. And we also know that housing is one of the big drivers of all wealth inequality. It's for most countries, it's not stocks and bonds, it's housing. And this is net wealth. So it's taking into account debt. So it even means that in some countries, the bottom shares. So we could take, for instance, the Netherlands. The bottom 40% actually have negative net wealth. So there is an even greater than, 0 to 100% divide here.
Okay, so when we see that graph, we will also have to pay attention where it comes into the minus owners.
Absolutely, to below the axis.
Okay, good. What about Luxembourg? Do you have stats for that? How does it work here?
Yeah, so this is 2015 data. It's coming from the OECD, and the top 10% of the wealth distribution in Luxembourg holds 48.7% of the wealth. So it's actually lower than the general European average.
Not that much, though.
Not that much. Yep. So it's more or less average. And then if we want to look, for instance, at the bottom 40% of the wealth distribution, they hold 3.9% of the wealth.
So we don't have negatives there.
But no, we do not have negatives there.
Okay. Maybe that's a positive note to finish on. I don't know. But definitely there's a lot to discuss and a lot to follow. Do check out also other episodes where we talk about inequality with Liza researchers and just to know a little bit more on that side. But I'm sure we will have Lindsay one day again to see once the Propel project is finished, what are the final outcomes and where you're going next. And yeah, do follow Housing Day. Hopefully next year, another event like that. So we will definitely inform about that. And thank you, Lindsay, very much for coming today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is it for today. Don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to rate us, tell us what you think, suggest guests. So we are present on basically all the social media and always very open for your opinion. This was Silax, and my name is Hanna Siemaszko.